Chapter 4. 3. February. February dusk on the Seine. The boats are plying again, but they stop at nightfall, and the river is inky smooth, with the same long weed-like reflections as in August. Only the reflections are fewer and paler. Bright lights are muffled everywhere. The line of the quays is scarcely discernible, and the heights of the Trocadero are lost in the blur of night, which presently effaces even the firm tower tops of Notre Dame. Down the damp pavements only a few street lamps throw their watery zigzags. The shops are shut, and the windows above them thickly curtained. The faces of the houses are all blind. In the narrow streets of the Rive Gauche the darkness is even deeper, and the few scattered lights in courts or heights create effects of Pierre's eye-like mystery. The gleam of the chestnut roaster's brazier at a street corner deepens the sense of an old adventurous Italy, and the darkness beyond seems full of cloaks and conspiracies. I turn, on my way home, into an empty street between high garden walls, with a single light showing far off at its farther end. Not a soul is in sight between me and that light. My steps echo endlessly in the silence. Presently a dim figure comes around the corner ahead of me. Man or woman? Impossible to tell till I overtake it. The February fog deepens the darkness, and the faces one passes are indistinguishable. As for the numbers of the houses, no one thinks of looking for them. If you know the quarter, you count doors from the corner, or try to puzzle out the familiar outline of a balcony or a pediment. If you are in a strange street, you must ask at the nearest tobacconist's for. As for finding a policeman, a yard off you couldn't tell him from your grandmother. Such, after 6 months of war, are the nights of Paris. The days are less remarkable and less romantic. Almost all the yearly flush and shiver of romance is gone, or so at least it seems to those who have watched the gradual revival of life. It may appear otherwise to observers from other countries, even from those involved in the war. After London, with all her theaters open, and her machinery of amusement almost unimpaired, Paris no doubt seems like a city on whom great issues weigh. But to those who lived through that first sunlit silent month, the streets today show an almost normal activity. The vanishing of all the motor buses, and of the huge lumbering commercial vans, leaves many a forgotten perspective open, and reveals many a lost grace of architecture. But the taxi cabs and private motors are almost as abundant as in peacetime, and the peril of pedestrianism is kept at its normal pitch by the incessant dashing to and fro of those unrivaled engines of destruction, the hospital and war office motors. Many shops have reopened, a few theaters are tentatively producing patriotic drama, or mixed programs seasonal with sentiment and mirth, and the cinema again unrolls its eventful kilometers. For a while, in September and October, the streets were made picturesque by the coming and going of English soldiery, and the aggressive flourish of British military motors. Then the fresh faces and smart uniforms disappeared, and now the nearest approach to militarism which Paris offers to the casual sightseer is the occasional drilling of a handful of pious on the muddy reaches of the Place des Invalides. But there is another army in Paris. Its first detachments came months ago, in the dark September day's lamentable rear guard of the Allies' retreat on Paris. Since then its numbers have grown and grown, its dingy streams have percolated through all the currents of Paris life, so that wherever one goes, in every quarter, and at every hour, among the busy, confident, strongly stepping Parisians one sees these other people, dazed and slowly moving men and women with sordid bundles on their backs, shuffling along hesitatingly in their tattered shoes, children dragging at their hands and tired-out babies pressed against their shoulders. The great army of the refugees. Their faces are unmistakable and unforgettable. No one who has ever caught that stare of dumb bewilderment, or that other look of concentrated horror, full of the reflection of flames and ruins, can shake off the obsession of the refugees. The look in their eyes is part of the look of Paris. It is the dark shadow on the brightness of the face she turns to the enemy. These poor people cannot look across the borders to eventual triumph. They belong mostly to a class whose knowledge of the world's affairs is measured by the shadow of their village steeple. They are no more curious of the laws of causation than the thousands overwhelmed at Avezzano. They were plowing and sowing, spinning and weaving and minding their business, when suddenly a great darkness full of fire and blood came down on them. And now they are here, in a strange country, among unfamiliar faces and new ways, with nothing left to them in the world but the memory of burning homes, and massacred children and young men dragged to slavery, of infants torn from their mothers, old men trampled by drunken heels and priests slain, while they prayed beside the dying. These are the people who stand in hundreds every day outside the doors of the shelters improvised to rescue them, and who receive, in return for the loss of everything that makes life sweet, or intelligible, or at least endurable, a cot in a dormitory, a meal ticket and perhaps, on lucky days, a pair of shoes. What are the Parisians doing meanwhile? For one thing, and the sign is a good one, they are refilling the shops, and especially, of course, the great department stores. In the early war days there was no stranger sight than those deserted palaces, where one strayed between miles of unpurchased wares in quest of vanished salesmen. A few clerks, of course, were left. Enough, one would have thought, for the rare purchasers who disturbed their meditations. But the few there were, did not care to be disturbed. They lurked behind their walls of sheeting, their bastions of flannelette, as if ashamed to be discovered. And when one had coaxed them out, they went through the necessary gestures automatically, as if mournfully wondering that anyone should care to buy. I remember once, at the Louvre, seeing the whole force of a epartement, including the salesman I was trying to cajole into showing me some medicated gauze, desert their posts simultaneously, to gather about a motorcyclist in a muddy uniform who had dropped in to see his pals with tails from the front. But after 6 months the pressure of normal appetites has begun to reassert itself, and to shop is one of the normal appetites of woman. I say hop instead of buy, to distinguish between the dull purchase of necessities and the voluptuousness of acquiring things one might do without. It is evident that many of the thousands now fighting their way into the great shops must be indulging in the latter delight. At a moment when real wants are reduced to a minimum, how else account for the congestion of the department store? Even allowing for the immense, the perpetual buying of supplies for hospitals and workrooms, the incessant stoking up of the innumerable centers of charitable production, there is no explanation of the crowding of the other departments except the fact that woman, however valiant, however tried, however suffering and however self-denying, must eventually, in the long run, and at whatever cost to her pocket and her ideals, begin to shop again. She has renounced the theater, she denies herself the tea rooms, she goes apologetically and furtively and economically to concerts, but the swinging doors of the department store suck her irresistibly into their quicksand of remnants and reductions. No one, in this respect, would wish the look of Paris to be changed. It is a good sign to see the crowds pouring into the shops again, even though the sight is less interesting than that of the other crowds streaming daily, and on Sunday in immensely augmented numbers across the Pont Alexander III, to the great court of the Invalides, where the German trophies are displayed. Here the heart of France beats with a richer blood, and something of its glow passes into foreign veins as one watches the perpetually renewed throng's face to face with the long triple row of German guns. There are few in those throngs to whom one of the deadly pack has not dealt a blow. There are personal losses, lacerating memories, bound up with the sight of all those evil engines. But personal sorrow is the sentiment least visible in the look of Paris. It is not fanciful to say that the Parisian face, after 6 months of trial, has acquired a new character. The change seems to have affected the very stuff it is molded of, as though the lawnmower deal had hardened the poor human clay into some dense commemorative substance. I often pass in the street women whose faces look like memorial medals, idealized images of what they were in the flesh. And the masks of some of the men, those queer tormented Gallic masks, crushed in and squat and a little satyr-like, look like the bronzes of the Naples Museum, burned and twisted from their baptism of fire. But none of these faces reveals a personal preoccupation. They are looking, one and all, at France erect on her borders. Even the women who are comparing different widths of Valenciennes at the lace counter all have something of that vision in their eyes, or else one does not see the ones who haven't. It is still true of Paris, that she has not the air of a capital in arms. There are as few troops to be seen as ever, and but for the coming and going of the orderlies attached to the War Office and the military government, and the sprinkling of uniforms about the doors of barracks, there would be no sign of war in the streets, no sign, that is, except the presence of the wounded. It is only lately that they have begun to appear, for in the early months of the war they were not sent to Paris, and the splendidly appointed hospitals of the capital stood almost empty, while others, all over the country, were overcrowded. The motives for the disposal of the wounded have been much speculated upon and variously explained. One of its results may have been the maintaining in Paris of the extraordinary moral health which has given its tone to the whole country, and which is now sound and strong enough to face the sight of any misery. And miseries enough it has to face. Day by day the limping figures grow more numerous on the pavement, the pale bandaged heads more frequent in passing carriages. In the stalls at the theaters and concerts there are many uniforms, and their wearers usually have to wait till the hall is emptied before they hobble out on a supporting arm. Most of them are very young, and it is the expression of their faces which I should like to picture and interpret as being the very essence of what I have called the look of Paris. They are grave, these young faces. One hears a great deal of the gaiety in the trenches, but the wounded are not gay. Neither are they sad, however. They are calm, meditative, strangely purified and matured. It is as though their great experience had purged them of pettiness, meanness, and frivolity, burning them down to the bare bones of character, the fundamental substance of the soul, and shaping that substance into something so strong and finely tempered that for a long time to come Paris will not care to wear any look unworthy of the look on their faces. In Argonne, I, the permission to visit a few ambulances and evacuation hospitals behind the lines gave me, at the end of February, my first sight of war. Paris is no longer included in the military zone, either in fact or in appearance. Though it is still manifestly under the war cloud, its air of reviving activity produces the illusion that the menace which casts that cloud is far off, not only in distance but in time. Paris, a few months ago so alive to the nearness of the enemy, seems to have grown completely oblivious of that nearness, and it is startling, not more than 20 miles from the gates, to pass from such an atmosphere of workaday security to the imminent sense of war. Going eastward, one begins to feel the change just beyond Meaux. Between that quiet episcopal city and the hill town of Montmirail, some 40 miles farther east, there are no sensational evidences of the great conflict of September only, here and there, in an unplowed field, or among the fresh brown furrows, a little mound with a wooden cross and a wreath on it. Nevertheless, one begins to perceive, by certain negative signs, that one is already in another world. On the cold February day, when we turned out of Meaux and took the road to the Argonne, the change was chiefly shown by the curious absence of life in the villages through which we passed. Now and then a lonely plowman and his team stood out against the sky, or a child and an old woman looked from a doorway, but many of the fields were fallow and most of the doorways empty. We passed a few carts driven by peasants, a stray woodcutter in a copse, a road mender hammering at his stones, But already the pavilion motor had disappeared, and all the dust-colored cars dashing past us were marked with the Red Cross, or the number of an army division. At every bridge and railway crossing, a sentinel, standing in the middle of the road with lifted rifle, stopped the motor and examined our papers. In this negative sphere there was hardly any other tangible proof of military rule. But with the descent of the first hill beyond Montmirail there came the positive feeling. This is war. Along the white road rippling away eastward over the dimpled country, the army motors were pouring by in endless lines, broken now and then by the dark mass of a tramping regiment, or the clatter of a train of artillery. In the intervals between these waves of military traffic we had the road to ourselves, except for the flashing past of dispatch bearers on motorcycles, and of hideously hooting little motors carrying goggled officers in goatskins and woolen helmets. The villages along the road all seemed empty, not figuratively but literally empty. None of them had suffered from the German invasion, save by the destruction, here and there, of a single house on which some random malice has wreaked itself. But since the general flight in September all have remained abandoned, or are provisionally occupied by troops, and the rich country between Montmirail and Chalons is a desert. The first sight of Chalons is extraordinarily exhilarating. The old town lying so pleasantly between canal and river is the headquarters of an army, not of a corps, or of a division, but of a whole army and the network of grey provincial streets about the Romanesque towers of Notre Dame rustles with the movement of war. The square before the principal hotel, the incomparably named Haute Mere Dieu, is as vivid a sight as any scene of modern war can be. Rows of grey motor lorries and omnibuses do not lend themselves to as happy groupings as a detachment of cavalry, and spitting and spurting motorcycles, and torpedo racers are no substitute for the glitter of helmets and the curveting of chargers. But once the eye has adapted itself to the ugly lines, and the neutral tints of the new warfare, the scene in that crowded clattering square becomes positively brilliant. It is a vision of one of the central functions of a great war, in all its concentrated energy, without the saddening suggestions of what, on the distant periphery, that energy is daily and hourly resulting in. Yet even here such suggestions are never long out of sight, for one cannot pass through Chalons without meeting, on their way from the station, a long line of cloaks, the unwounded but battered, shattered, frostbitten, deafened and half-paralyzed wreckage of the awful struggle. These poor wretches, in their thousands, are daily shipped back from the front, to rest and be restored. And it is a grim sight to watch them limping by, and to meet the dazed stare of eyes, that have seen what one dare not picture. If one could think away the eclipse in the streets, and the wounded in their hospitals, Chalons would be an invigorating spectacle. When we drove up to the hotel, even the grey motors and the sober uniforms seemed to sparkle under the cold sky. The continual coming and going of alert and busy messengers, the riding up of officers for some still ride, the arrival of much decorated military personages in luxurious motors, the hurrying to and fro of orderlies, the perpetual depleting and refilling of the long rows of grey vans across the square, the movements of Red Cross ambulances, and the passing of detachments for the front, all these are sights that the Pacific stranger could forever gape at. And in the hotel, what a clatter of swords, what a piling up of fur coats and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.